Hey, deep fried fans, have you ever had fried dill pickles? They are a great appetizer and can be found throughout the South. This is Ellie Mae here to announce show number 11. Today, Keith and Woody sit down with Joe Stagner, who is known as Microsoft's opinionated misfit geek. Today's show is about security, something every developer needs to think about. Joe joined Microsoft in 2001 as an ISV development technical advisor and is now a senior program manager on the developer tools and platforms team. His development experiences have afforded him the opportunity to create commercial software applications across a wide diversity of technical platforms, from mainframes through Unix and Linux to Microsoft technologies on the Intel and mobile computing platforms. In recent years, Joe has been focused on highly performant geoscalable web application architectures, multi-platform interoperability, especially PHP, and writing secure code. Okay, deep fried fans, brush off that nasty hurricane season, grab that glass of sweet tea, and get ready for some Gumpology.
Mr. Woody, what's up, sir?
Not too much, Brother Elder. How about you?
Doing good. Still recovering from DevLink, so a little tired.
I am too. Man, that was a great weekend. The trip home on the DevLink bus was a little bit adventurous with the blown tire and 4 hours in front of a Waffle House in northern Kentucky.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy. You guys had to deal with all that, man. But, you know, so is the ways of the world.
I know. We had great conversations, and it was great. So I'm going to do it again next year.
Cool. Well, I drove all the way from Hattiesburg up to Nashville, as you know, and drove back and was basically your tour guide for the several days there.
Yeah, thank you. You got a nice ride. So thank you for hauling my butt around to and from the event.
Well, it was no problem. We recorded some shows at DevLink, and we got one coming up here with Joe Stagnar, and we're going to talk about security. We recorded the show in the speaker's room at DevLink on the third floor, and we had some people that were still preparing and doing stuff in the room, and we've done a lot of post-production work on this, trying to get that stuff out of the way so it doesn't interfere too much. And I think the end result's pretty clean here, Woody.
Yeah, it is a good show, so I'm really happy about it.
Okay, folks. Well, we don't want to keep you holding around and listen to us, so let's go ahead and get off to DevLink, folks. Here we go, live from DevLink with Joe Stagnar.
Enjoy, guys.
Today we're sitting here at DevLink with Mr. Joe Stagnar. Joe, how are you?
Hi, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Joe, for coming on board.
My pleasure.
Well, today, folks, we're going to talk about security. And, well, I think we're going to talk about hackers and the devs who love them.
Yeah, or devs who hate them.
Devs who hate them.
Does anybody love them?
I don't know if anybody does, but
well, the good ones that tell the devs where the hacks are so they can fix them. So I mean, so
we've all come to hate them. That's for sure.
Well,
huh?
So you know, my team owns a bunch of the Microsoft Developer Community properties, so the ASP.NET website and Silverlight.NET, IIS.NET, WindowsClient.NET, and I don't think we've ever had anybody email us and tell us about a vulnerability. We on occasion detect somebody looking for them, but.
So you hit an interesting point. Why don't you explain like what you do and maybe some of your job roles at Microsoft?
I'd love to if I knew. So I've been with Microsoft for about 7 years, and I started out as an ISV advisor, and then worked with the MSDN events group for a while, and then a few years ago, I was always a serial startup guy. So I built companies and. And when I came to Microsoft, I actually had come out of a deal, sold the company that I built, and I was going to start another company. And I had an appointment to go pick up the first check for venture capital on September 13th in 2001, 2 days after the terrorist attacks.
How'd that work out for you?
Well, so not so good.
Right.
Because even if they still wanted to do the deal, they couldn't have got their hands on the money. In fact, my appointment was just like a few blocks from the World Trade Center towers. So they wanted to wait 6 months, but I'd already taken a few months off and had cleared the honey-do list and didn't want to, 6 months of adding to it. So I had some, you know, some standing conversations with companies like Microsoft and IBM, and I thought Microsoft would be more fun for a year because I was only going to do it for a year.
Sure.
And that
sure.
was 7 years ago. So a few years ago, I decided, I thought maybe it was time to start another company, and I actually resigned from Microsoft. I hadn't publicly announced, but I'd resigned, and Scott Guthrie got wind of it and called me up and said, you know, I want to talk to you. And a couple days later, he called me and said, I want you to come to work for me. And I said, okay, what will I do? And he said, well, I don't know, but say yes, and we'll figure it out. And that was 3 years ago, and I'm still not exactly sure that I have a formal job description. We've just this year we've actually added some people to the team for a long time. It was just me and Simon Muzio doing a lot of community stuff, but out of the product groups. And I've recently been informed that internally we're referred to as Scott Guthrie's private ninja army.
Nice. Yep. He's
I've heard of him.
He's got more ninjas coming on board. Like Hanselman, I think, is in your area.
He just joined our team about 6 months ago.
Right, right.
And so he and I talk a lot. So but one of the things that I've done, so historically, so my title, it actually says on my business card, Opinionated Misfit Geek. and my blog address is Misfit Geek, and I got that from a manager at Microsoft because I'm sort of always the other voice, and
right.
I'm always willing to take on stuff that other folks don't want to do, right? So either because our PR firm says it's, you know, sort of a hairy topic, and one of the ones has been security because remember starting back in when I started at Microsoft in 2001, you know, there were a lot of big high visibility security vulnerabilities that took place, the slammer worm and that sort of thing, and so folks didn't really want to talk about security because it was a hard conversation to have with customers. So I've been doing that, you know, among other things at Microsoft for 7 years.
And you've been doing a lot of stuff with open source. You play with a lot of stuff like PHP and whatever kind of moves out there. Are you kind of like the pulse guy as to what's going on the other side of the fence too, sort of?
So, yeah. So one of the things that I do a lot of is work with development technologies that are not made by Microsoft. And I do that for the purposes of figuring out what do developers need. You know, how do we, you know, what kind of feedback can I generate back into the feature teams in the various product groups in terms of, you know, what we're doing right, what we're doing that needs improvement, what other folks are doing that is of interest to developers. And that's one of the really cool things about working for Scott is that, you know, I'll on occasion get a phone call from Scott or an email and says, hey, I want you to go find out everything there is to know about why developers love X. And then I'll go off and do it. Maybe go to a couple conferences or go to a training and, you know, and dive down for the purposes of figuring out, you know, what's missing in our product set that developers really would like us to build.
If the goo ever needs anybody else to do that, just keep me on the list there. So
I will add you to that list. I have to say that it's a
probably
pretty
long,
and growing list
of people. That's what sounds like a great job, really, seriously.
When I joined DevDiv, I was the first, or at least folklore has it, that I was the first product team employee that was ever allowed to come to work and not make a commitment to move to Redmond. And it's not that I'm averse to Redmond. I go there all the time and I love it. It's just that I'm an old guy that got remarried and has little kids again, and I just can't afford to add a bunch of money to my mortgage. So I stay on the East Coast and travel back and forth. But since I went into that position, we've hired a bunch of guys that do similar things. We've got Jesse Liberty, who lives in Massachusetts, who does Silverlight, and we've got Tim Heuer, who lives in Phoenix, I believe, who does Silverlight. We've got Scott Hanselman,
right.
who's
yep.
in Portland.
Right.
So yeah, we're becoming really virtual.
You are, yeah. I actually work remote as well, so we can share some tips later on.
Yeah, that's right. your path and mine have crossed in the past.
It has. Sure has. We've hugged.
Virtually.
Yeah.
So security and bad hackers out there. So I mean, we came with this idea and. We were saying it's not very glamorous.
Yeah, well, so, yeah, I was surprised, you know, as I was saying earlier, that here we've got this, at DevLink, we've got this awesome, like, 2 days worth of open spaces, and the participation there is really exciting. But the one thing that I was surprised about was that for all of the sessions that were proposed, none of them were security related. And, you know, I suppose that one could say security is not glamorous, but, you know, yeah, it's certainly exciting if the code that you wrote is the product of a successful hack that makes it to the cover of the Wall Street Journal tomorrow. And Pete, when I say that, people think I'm joking. But you know, my team owns the ASP.NET website, so we're talking, you know, really huge numbers of visitors. And you know, we detect potentially malicious activity on a regular basis. And you know, I'm in large part responsible for the architecture and security initiatives around the site. And you know, I lose sleep, and my boss Simon Muzio, who owns all of the DevDiv, you know, community sites, you know, we lose sleep on a regular basis, because that's an absolute reality for us, that if we have a security breach where, you know, user credentials are disclosed, you know, it's absolutely something we're going to read about on the cover of the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. And, you know, not to mention Slashdot and, you know, every place else.
Yeah, right. And read on dozens of blogs.
So that would guarantee that I got to start a new company.
You know, it would take, you know, it takes you 10 years and you had no security problems, and it takes one and you suck.
Right.
That's the perception.
Absolutely. And, you know, so people joke that it's not glamorous. I actually think that being a security specialist in the developer space is a really exciting thing to be. I mean, you think about it. It's the ultimate video game, right? The ultimate single-person shooter, man. It's me against him, that guy out there.
Well, really, or it's you against all of them, really.
Well, yeah, one at a time.
This just popped in my head. So, Joe, I know in your past you used to be a professional fighter. So you could correlate fighting to security, a fight, a counter move, and it could be just like that, but in a virtual space where you're fighting against all the other bad guy that's in front of you, trying to keep them from knocking you out and knocking your website or your network out.
So it's interesting that you make that analogy, because I think it's a really accurate one, and it's at the root of what I think is the primary problem that prevents us as an industry from generally developing secure software. So, you know, I was a professional fighter for like 14 years, and now I'm just an old fat happy guy. But I still train fighters, and as a coach in the professional ranks, I have a win percentage of like over 93%. And the reason is that, you know, at that level, how I choose to train my athletes is not to develop the best set of skills that they can, but on a one-by-one basis, we specifically train on not how to beat somebody, but how to beat that particular person. And so, you know, so like I've got a guy that's getting ready for a world title fight, but I've been training for 4 months, watching videotapes, you know, breaking down what the other guy does, being able to emulate his style so that when I go in there and hold pads for him or spar with him, I can look as much as possible like the other guy. And, you know, I used to work in federal law enforcement also. In law enforcement, they have a saying, to catch a bad guy, you need to think like a bad guy.
Right.
But that's counterintuitive to the way that we develop software, right? And the way that we test software, for the most part, we get a spec, whether it's on the back of a napkin or it's in 16 volumes of stuff that systems analysts built. And
exactly.
Then as architects and project managers and developers, we write an application to implement the features that were requested in the problem that was described to us. And then when we evaluate how our code works, whether it's the developer testing his own code or the QA department, we test the application according to how it was supposed to work, not how it was not intended to work. And, you know, so it's counterintuitive to our thought process to go in and approach our applications in ways that we've never thought about how they might be misused. And you know, I think that's one of the things that has to change, is that we have to have groups of people on every software project that learn how to approach applications maliciously outside of the scope of the thought process that was used to design and create that application in the first place.
So in a medium to large size development shop, do you think there's a role for this bad guy role, that all they do is think about, plan, and act on being the black hat hacker? So
designated bad guy.
Yeah.
It's an official schmuck
yeah.
on the team. So, I mean, IT pro organizations have these guys, white hat hackers, you know, or white hat security specialists, who, you know, their job is to, you know, do pen testing to try and get in to evaluate changes that are going to be made to the infrastructure. But in development teams, we don't generally have those guys, or at least not widespread. So first of all, I don't think this is a role that needs to be assumed in only medium to large teams. I think there should be a guy with a security focus in all development teams of size one or greater. So you know, obviously, if it's a two or three person team, and you know, then it's not one full time guy. But there's got to be somebody that takes the lead, that at least starts the thought process around what are the security implications of this decision at the code level. So there are, you know, one of the tough things about security is that you can't know what you don't know. So if you haven't spent time with your head in the security space from a developer's perspective, it's hard to imagine what the vulnerabilities are other than from a press release perspective. Like, you know, developers know there are mistakes that I could make that will result in, you know, our e-commerce database being stolen, and that's bad. But I think, you know, at a, you know, sort of a day-to-day, hour-by-hour perspective, it's hard to start to wrap your head around the kinds of impact that vulnerabilities or decisions, you know, that you make, how they can affect the security of your code.
Sure, so exactly.
And one of the important things to remember is that there's certainly a category of defects that can be retrofitted. If you have a script injection error or a SQL injection error that is in your code, that's a coding defect, and that can be fixed retroactively. So, you know, you can post shipment, you can find. So I found one on one of our web properties last week, a script injection vulnerability that, you know, boom, I, you know, entered an item and 2 hours later the fix was in production. But there are a whole collection of security defects that can't be fixed by patching code. They start at the architectural level. So I think there's got to be, even if it's not a full-time person, there's got to be somebody that management designates, both from a, you know, both from a timing and authority perspective as well as from an educational investment perspective. This is the person that's going to be our security catalyst, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Now, you mentioned a couple of things. You mentioned SQL injection. That's one of the things that, you know, we kind of hear is kind of like the starting point of security for devs is, you know, write secure code. Don't let people inject SQL stuff into your database, right? And then you mentioned like scripting. So like Ajax has kind of brought on a new level of security for developers to deal with, right? What are the other topics in there? Like if you gave like 5 or 10, I mean, what are your baselines for?
Well, so before that,
okay,
you did what lots of developers do. Scripting, so SQL injection, yeah, I get it. Script injection, yeah, I get it. And I cringe when that happens because, so SQL injection, for example, there are lots of ways, you know, there are lots of things that can happen with SQL injection that, you know, it's not as simple as, you know, oh, yeah, filter your input. And a lot of people, they see a simple SQL injection attack and they say, oh, yeah, so they can get access to records in the database that, you know, that they shouldn't. But SQL injection, so if you write an application, one input form that has a SQL injection vulnerability in it, and you're running it on a SQL Server instance that's not hardened, then depending on the service account privileges, I can own your entire network. Not some data in that application. I can own your entire network. So now again, there are a couple of dependencies, but if that happens, basically the only way that you can be sure, if you have a vulnerability, a SQL injection vulnerability, and the user account is running with administrative privileges, and that box and that SQL Server instance have not been hardened, I can install rootkits or other executable code, not just on that SQL Server box, but on anything that's connected to that SQL Server box. So basically, if you have that vulnerability in your application and I breach your application, the only way that you can be sure that I'm eradicated from your infrastructure is to unplug all the boxes and start with FDisk. So, you know, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And SQL injection.
And I wasn't downplaying that either. I'm just saying, like, that's something that we hear a lot about.
Sure.
You know? I mean, it's something we hear a lot about. It has drastic
repercussions.
With it, you know, yeah, sure.
Script injection is another one. So I've been doing a talk for the last year on Web 2.0 attack. And a lot of people think, well, it's just JavaScript running in the browser. So how much damage could you really do? And the answer to that question is, you know, I'm going to put these in videos that are on demand because people see them and they freak. The stuff that you can do, granted, the attack model is different. So when you're doing a JavaScript-based attack, you're doing something running in the browser and it's not an ActiveX controller or what have you, the engagement model is different. So a lot of the vulnerability comes from what I can trick the user into doing. But still, there's a ton of stuff that can happen there. One of the one of the JavaScript applications that I've written, or at least prototyped, is a script injection framework where basically I inject some reasonably persistent code, and it monitors everything that you do, and it sends every keystroke back to a server of my choice someplace, which, you know, think about the kinds of things every keystroke that you enter. Well, and this happens all the time. Like I did a speaking tour for Microsoft a few years ago where we had gotten some security content from a vendor, and that always makes me nuts that, you know, if Microsoft folks are going to talk about security, I want us to talk about security from our, you know, from our own learnings. But I wrote a SQL injection demo, and it was the first thing that I showed at the beginning. This is a 4-hour talk that I gave, and I put it at the beginning of the talk because I wanted it to sort of grab people's attention and, you know, get them to really embrace how dangerous this stuff is. And the organizers, after the second day that I presented it, the organizers asked me if I would move that to the end of my talk because I was showing that first thing and people were getting up and leaving because they needed to get back to the office right now.
Wow. That's a good story.
But you were scaring, but that's good. I mean, that's what Microsoft really needs to do is they have world-class products, but the whole key is how to build those best practices and guidance and come back to where we were in the beginning. It's not glamorous. So you just have to make a point. You have to have someone that's there that, I mean, I guess you need to find those people that find being the bad guy, being the hacker on the team, fun.
Well, so finding that guy can be really important. And the other thing is that, I mean, security is a factor of quality. And, you know, as we're doing more and more things with connected applications, not just public-facing internet applications like e-commerce sites, but the more we're building connected applications, the more security becomes a success criteria. And, you know, the FBI's a recent report from the FBI on cybercrime indicated that as much as 50% of successful hacking activity comes from inside your organization, your consultants, your employees, you know, et cetera. So, you know, it's really not just a, you know, an Amazon.com or a Microsoft.com problem. And so from that perspective, you know, being the guy that solves problems in advance and delivers real high quality, you know, high quality work, you know, most of us are really proud of the code that we write. So it would seem to me that as awareness increases, building security into the applications that you build is just part of being a great developer, and people would want to do that.
So you hit on one thing. So connected systems, are you finding that there's the potential for really severe hacks in a, we'll take a service-oriented architecture? Do you find that companies that have a lot of these web services exposed are even at a greater advantage of being hacked?
I think that's potentially true. So there's a lot of dialogue about how Ajax and SOA increase vulnerability, and I think that's, you know, maybe it's semantics, but there's nothing new in this technology. But the way that we're using this technology means that we're exposing a lot more API surface to the cloud. We're leveraging JavaScript a lot more. We're building applications that are much more chatty because of this whole sort of Web 2.0 phenomenon. And the end result of that is, because there's more API opening, there's more conversation between client and server, whatever that client is, that means that we're sort of expanding the number of potential vulnerabilities, especially since we're doing this at a rapid pace and we're not offsetting that rapid pace with proper education of developers on how to build secure applications. So the technology is there. If you look at like the WS-Stack, WS Security and such, there's a lot of good technology that's available to build service-oriented applications and do it in a very secure way. The problem is that that stuff's not really simple. You know, the current implementations of that stuff is not really simple.
It is very complex.
The other thing is that there's part of the whole SOAP phenomenon is that, particularly in the interop space, SOAP has some complexities. And so REST is becoming very popular, partly due to its lack of complexity, and partly because for a lot of the Ajax-style work that we're doing, we just don't need the overhead of SOAP and all of the XML that, you know, travels over the, you know, over the wire. But, you know, one of the problems is that as we're adding these sort of simple, unsecured conversational mechanisms to our applications, it can create additional opportunities for bad guys to steal data, steal service, mess with our infrastructure, cause denial of service, that sort of stuff.
So I want to go back a little bit, Joe. Let's go back and try to give most of our audiences developers for the most part. So where would a developer start to think about security in their applications? What are some tips that you can give them?
Wow, so that's a great question. You know, it's funny that I'm not much of a methodologies guy. You know, I don't dive into the arguments about test-driven development or agile or this or that. But I've agreed to work with the SDL team at Microsoft to do a whole bunch of work, and SDL stands for Secure Development Lifecycle, to do a whole bunch of work to sort of talk about the SDL and demonstrate how folks can add Secure Development Lifecycle to whatever process it is that they're using. And the sort of entry tier to that is, I believe, to do threat modeling, and not after you've written code, but, you know, when you start talking about the problem that you're going to solve.
Give me an example of that. Just the hello world of threat modeling, if you will.
So, you know, start with, you know, some application, right? So I'm toying with a community prototype, basically a social networking for athletes. And they're going to be able to it's for fighting athletes, boxers and MMA guys and kickboxers. And so they'll be able to do a lot of things like, you know, post their own videos. But a large part, I want to facilitate the sport. I want to find training partners. And I'm traveling to Nashville, Tennessee for a week. I want to find training partners I might be able to hook up with while I'm there. Or I want to make matches. And I want to find, you know, statistically, I want to make some good matches.
Okay.
So that's sort of the basic problem that I want to solve. And a little bit, just a little bit about the data that's going to be involved. And so right at that stage, I start thinking about what can go wrong, right? So obviously, personal information associated with all of those member profiles. You know, what can go wrong if that gets disclosed? What's it mean to my business? You know, and threat modeling starts before the what's the outcome and how do I fix it? Threat modeling starts at how do I decompose my application? How do I find out what the targets are going to be? Both from a, not from a how are they going to hack my application to get to that, but in fact, what are the assets that I need to protect? This data, maybe it's this service, right? So if if I publish that query mechanism, how to match guys up through a web service, then that service in and of itself becomes an asset that can be both stolen if it's a paid service, or can be interrupted if it's not a paid service, but if, you know, there's some malicious activity that folks want to steal the data, they can create a service interruption, denial of service. So, you know, the threat modeling process is there's a pretty good book on threat modeling. If you just search threat modeling like on Amazon.com, there's also a great threat modeling tool on Microsoft.com. If you just go to Microsoft.com and search threat modeling tool, you'll get the latest version, and it comes with a pretty straightforward sample of, I think it's a Fabricam phone, which is, so it sounds sort of silly, but when you look at the threat model for the Fabricam phone, how you do that logical decomposition makes sense.
So threat modeling is just a model. It's not actually like what you're going to actually do in code. So what are some sample tips and things that developers should be thinking about when they're in code now?
Well, so the first thing is there's no substitute for education. I mean, you have to get some sort of education, whether it's, you know, reading or watching videos or something, just to start the vocabulary about the kinds of things that you need to look for in your code. There are a couple of things that you can do depending on what kind of code you're writing. The first is to start with a framework that has some security features built in, and it's one of the things that the experts say is comparatively advantageous to the .NET framework. So aside from all of the other things you can say about, you know, the .NET framework versus other frameworks and what the benefits are, there's a lot of, particularly for web application developers, there's a lot of security built in, both automatically enabled as well as a lot of namespace delivery that's available to enhance your secure coding.
You know, I actually did some research on that a while back. I was comparing some technologies that will not be named, and I was looking at the actual security stuff in the .NET framework, and there were, I don't know, let's say 3 vulnerabilities that were found, and in other technologies there were like 43 in 1 year. So, I mean, that it there have been some security holes in there, but not a lot that I've seen, really, to be honest.
No, we've so
that's good. I mean, that's really good.
So harken back to the sort of 2001 timeframe when we had all of these really high visibility security vulnerabilities, particularly in IIS. Really, the work of guys like Michael Howard, who wrote Writing Secure Code, and other guys like J.D. Meyer in the Patterns and Practices Group have really changed the way that Microsoft develops software. And every product that Microsoft is developed using a secure development lifecycle. So if you look at the results, like you mentioned, in terms of, you know, critical vulnerabilities, you know, IIS 4.5 had a really bad security reputation because of some of those big, you know, those big holes that were found. But if you look at IIS 6 and IIS 7, to date, no critical security vulnerabilities ever. Right? So it doesn't mean no vulnerabilities at all, but no critical security vulnerabilities reported. So the secure development lifecycle has really improved the way that, you know, we develop security in the applications that we build.
Well, you know, the mindset back, and I've said this publicly many times, that there is no way that I would have put IIS 4.5 on the internet at all back then. That was just a perception that I had, that it was, and I had to actually go back and look at IIS 6 whenever, you know, I started looking at .NET later on. I had to go back and look at that, and I was surprised at what I found. But back then, that was a really bad time for security for Microsoft, I think. And it's the ship has been turned.
It was a terrible time, and you know, some of it was, you know, some of it was just things in the code. Some of it was that malicious activity was rapidly on the rise, and we have the largest operating system penetration for business applications. So we, you know, we're an interesting target for bad guys. And that same FBI report on cybercrime indicates that the vast majority of hacking activity today is not script kiddies that are looking to deface somebody's web page. It's organized crime.
Right.
So 75% to 85% organized crime. So the bad guys on the other end have changed. But, you know, a lot of people think that Microsoft folks are brainwashed about Microsoft products. And, you know, when you sit, you know, in a room in Building 42, you know, when you're talking about vNext or the next service pack, exactly the opposite is true. I mean, we are so critical of our own stuff. And, you know, don't get me wrong. I interface with the IIS team, and I've got all kinds of requests that haven't been made yet. And I want, you know, we recently did a URL rewriter, and I want it to work this way. And so, you know, we've got lots of input to all of our product groups.
Sure.
But the IIS team has done, in my opinion, a staggeringly good job at locking down security. And if you look, especially with the IIS 7 release, some of the interesting things about the security implementation of IIS 7 is that the security model expands to enable our applications to be more secure. So it's not just the process isolation that they've built into IIS, or, you know, how they've secured the code, how they've changed the execution model, but things like, you know, I can deploy applications in IIS, give them their own work, you know, give them their own app domain, specify how much CPU utilization it can consume before a recycle, how much memory can be consumed before a recycle. So there are a lot of things that are available now that, you know, can increase the security of our infrastructure as a whole that we just didn't have, you know, even a year ago.
Well, Woody, we got a new sponsor this week called DevExpress. You ever heard of them?
I've heard of them. I use them.
Me too. I use CodeRush a lot.
Yeah, I use Refactor Pro a lot, but I also use CodeRush a lot. I use them both.
It never fails when I go out and I speak someplace, I do a presentation, and then I go out and mingle with the crowd. People always say, "How did you write that stuff so fast?" And I say, "Well, I use CodeRush to code all the objects and all the classes and everything with." And that's when people actually see somebody using it, like, you know, in a real environment. That's when they really start to actually get it, that it will increase their productivity.
Exactly. And all the keystrokes that it will save you, and just the time. For the price, it's a small price to pay for giving you such power at your fingertips.
Absolutely. You know, they also make ASP.NET tools and controls, as well as WinForm controls as well. So You know, guys, if you haven't checked them out, go out there and give them a whirl. $250 for Code Rush and Refactor. I mean, you'll get that back in a few days once you know the product. Thanks again to Dev Express for supporting the show.
We've been talking about maybe people's roles, people's thinking. Are there any resources out there at Microsoft or maybe in the partner ecosystem that will search out and scan and do, on the developer side, do things and enlighten the developers on possible hacking vulnerabilities, like something like an FX cop, but for vulnerabilities? Is there something like that?
So there are, yes. So the short answer to the question is yes. There are tools out there, I'm not gonna sort of plug anyone in particular, but there are tools out there to do research on. I'm working on an article for my blog where I'll sort of hear a bunch that I've tried. And the market is changing very quickly. There are lots of really great small companies like Spy Dynamics had an awesome tool and a bunch of really brilliant, sort of white hat guys, and companies, in their case, it was HP, looked at them and said, hey, this is a space where there's not a whole lot of intellectual property out there. You know, we can't build it in anywhere close to the time that we could acquire it, so we're just going to buy them. And now Spy Dynamics is a division of HP. So those tools, those tools are great. I highly, highly recommend, though, that if companies are going to, if they have an application that's deployed and they have concerns about security, or they're about to deploy something and they're not sure about security because their own people aren't security experts, take the shortcut and go hire a top-notch pen testing firm to do it, the pen testing for you. That's not, it's like insurance, right? I don't say, hey, could you, I'm a little worried about if I die, my family's going to be taken care of. Here's $100. there's some risks that you just don't take.
Right.
There are automated tools out there. The tough part about automated tools, though, is just like any other computer application, it can only do what you tell it to do.
Exactly.
Ted Neward talked a lot earlier about unit testing. So folks, I talk to folks sometimes that write unit testing and they think that their security bases are covered. Well, are you specifically writing security-related unit testing as opposed to operational testing? And the other thing is just, we have to raise awareness. And it's one of those things that, nobody thinks it can happen until it happens to them. And I can tell you, it's like when I do security talks and I raise my hands and say, okay, for all you web developers, how many of you have worked on a web application that have been hacked? And maybe, 10% of the people will raise their hands. And then I explain to them that the only difference between the people that raised the hands and the people that didn't raise their hands is the folks that raised their hands, the guys that attacked them weren't as good as the guys that attacked the rest of you because they got found out.
Give us a basic, thing that developers are doing that you're seeing, Joe, that they could fix. I mean, give them some meat, like a tip on either in the web or WinForms or services or something.
There are so many. The number one thing that I would love to inspect code and never see again is for folks to never write SQL code dynamically at runtime. And I understand there are certain types of queries whose semantics can't be known at design time. But at a bare minimum, there are a million reasons to use stored procedures whenever you can. And I know it's a little bit of extra work for the developer, and the developer's not a SQL Server guy, but stored procedures create a high level of safety. Now, they're not ubiquitously, risk-free because we often see downstream attacks where the person who took the data in from wherever it came from a user input screen someplace, put the data in the database, just because he was recording it, he wasn't going to use it. So he didn't filter it on the way in. Then the guy who took it out of the database assumed that the guy who put it in the database filtered it before he did. And even though he's using a stored procedure to retrieve that, he's assuming that it's safe when he takes it in.
Right.
It's not.
Okay, now I'm going to get a lot of comments and emails that people are going to say, Joe Stegner from Microsoft said not to use auto-generated SQL and use stored procedures for everything. So, I mean, go back and clarify that. I mean, there's ORMs like in Hibernate, and you got the entity framework and all of those things. I mean, are you saying don't use that and use stored procedures, Joe? I mean, where's the line there?
So, Yeah. So okay. Yeah, I'm saying, whenever possible, if security is a high concern, use stored procedures whenever possible. It doesn't mean don't filter your input, don't evaluate user input. Use stored procedures when you can. If you can't use stored procedures, at a bare minimum, always use parameterized queries. So you can write dynamic parameterized queries just as easily as you can write, you know, dynamic SQL code. So I'd say, you know, if you're using, you know, something that generates code and it's not generating parameterized queries as opposed to raw SQL, then you want to be really certain that application, that code generator, is also responsible for handling all of the security questions that need to be asked about the data that's going to pass through that. And one of the things, you know, people forget that, you know, one of the things is you asked about, you know, what's the low-hanging fruit? Where do developers focus that are starting to try and get the head around security? It's not just data input and data display. It's any place that data crosses a trust boundary. Right? So whenever data moves from one place to another, there's a potential for a security vulnerability there. So, with all due respect to all of the folks that are building tools that generate code out there, wherever possible, you know, you're going to eliminate potential defects by using stored procedures when you can, by using parameterized queries wherever you can. And if there's some reason that you just can't do those things, then make sure that you make no assumptions about the safety of what's being passed from place to place.
So, Joe, we always like to ask kind of war stories and chatter that you look back on and have a good laugh now but caused a lot of grief, and maybe people can learn from it. So give us some war stories from your past.
So the ASP.NET website, for example, it's a huge property, and we have, you know, millions of visitors and you know, page views, and I think we're, you know, like the homepage, I think, is close to a million page views a day. And we, you know, we regularly detect activity that may be, that either is proven to be malicious of intent or might be. And so when Simon and I, Simon came to work, Simon Muzio was my boss. He's worked for Microsoft for a long, long time. And when he picked up all of these community properties, the state of the ASP.NET website, I mean, it started out as, you know, just a deployment of some forums code that Rob Howard, who's now, he's since left Microsoft and founded Intelligent. But he wrote that code, and that sort of is, you know, the ASP.NET website has grown up organically out of that. So, you know, as the ASP.NET website became sort of the premier web developer's homepage, when Simon and I started working together, we started talking about, geez, you know, if we ever get hacked, it's going to be really ugly. And I can only talk about this now because we've already done all of the diligence. But so we started to do sort of detailed evaluation, and that's always like a really terrible thing because you find one thing, and then you find that one thing points you to a bunch of more stuff. And we found out, you know, things where, you know, in terms of one of the jobs about being responsible for security is to think in worst case scenarios, right? So like, what if somebody actually got access to the database? What can they see as opposed to what's encrypted and they can't see without the keys, that sort of thing. So, you know, one thing that that happened to us was that we engaged a third-party white hat organization who did a detailed analysis for us using a combination of manual process as well as automated process, which in my personal opinion is the best approach, right? So we had taken bids from a couple of organizations. This is one we thought was the best approach. They went through, and surprisingly, they found very, very few security vulnerabilities. I mean, what we could count, you know, count on fingers probably. And so we fixed all of them, and we were comfortable, and there were a couple of other sort of higher level things that weren't vulnerabilities, but were things that we wanted to change. And some of them were big deal architectural things, and we did that. And so we were feeling really pretty good about the state of security. And then we periodically get together, several of us, and have just sort of, you know, do site reviews. We look at content and talk about, you know, what do we want to do with the content? What are some of the big bets for the next version? What do people want? And so I was tinkering away at something, and I found a JavaScript vulnerability, a script injection vulnerability, in a place like where there was no way it should have been there. And so like we stopped and spent several hours going through every other place in the site. You know, like, and here we are, we're in Redmond, supposed to be doing something else, talking about future version of the site, and all of a sudden it's like all hands on deck, and we've got, you know, a bunch of us hovering over a computer going through all of the places where logic would suggest that that code might get, you know, might have been reused. And we found a few of them, and they were all second tier, so they were all, you know, they were, none of the vulnerabilities were could have been immediately leveraged, but depending on where the data was going to end up, there might have been, you know, down level vulnerabilities. And so we just, you know, we're all up, we spent the night fixing them and getting them into production the next day.
You know, we talked to some MSCOM guys that they actually run, it was Brad and Jim, wasn't it? Yeah. They run Microsoft.com, you know, star, basically all of that stuff. And it was really interesting to talk about how they scale that system and that site. And they told us something that we found very interesting from a security standpoint was that they don't have any firewall. It's just IIS sitting out there on the net, and there's nothing really out there. There was no magic bullet secret thing, you know?
Well, they had one thing.
Well, they had a filter, some kind of...
Cisco hardware
that filters stuff out. And then they were saying, like, they get attacked, like, constantly. It's like they have found stuff that they route, filter it out, but it's still going on. You know, it's constant out there. I can't imagine, like, how much stuff you guys get attacked with on that.
That's one of the great things about filtering switches or firewalls, that you can basically train them to just not let certain kinds of traffic into your infrastructure. And that's especially important for denial of service attacks, because generally denial of service attacks execute code, not malicious code, the code that your application, you know, search functionality, or basically if you're going to leverage a denial of service attack, the idea is to find a function that's really resource intensive and then find a way to call it a million times simultaneously.
From 400 computers across the internet.
Right. So the great thing that you can do with some front-end hardware is to be able to train that front-end hardware to just not answer requests of a particular type or that come from a particular area. And we do that on the ASP.NET site every once in a while in response to an alert that we get. We'll shut off a range of IP addresses or a particular type of request. And sometimes it might be malicious activity. Other times it might be just, you know, a search bot that's stuck or, you know... But part of what for me is a natural outcome of doing good security work is that you ensure the performance of your application. I mean, you know, we have, because of the scope of users we have a very, very avid, very high level of communication with our, you know, with our users. And I'm not saying that tongue in cheek at all. I'm saying it in the best possible
the best
way.
Possible way, yeah.
But you know, when performance is bad, we definitely get a lot of, you know, instant feedback. So, you know, the ability to sort of agilely tweak what our servers are answering is how we maintain performance.
It's always a case of I was up for 99.99999%, but that 1 second you were down is on slash.net.
Well, let me tell you that one of the things that I've discovered about Scott Guthrie, who I love working for, right? I mean, truthfully, I wouldn't be at Microsoft if I wasn't working
for Scott.
Insert
bonus and raise.
Yeah. No, that's so. no, he doesn't participate in that process, or at least not that I know of. So, but the one of the interesting things about Scott is, first of all, he doesn't sleep. And that was before he had a baby. He doesn't sleep. So if ASP.NET goes down for 60 seconds at 3 o'clock in the morning,
He knows.
Wow.
It's kind of like just he has some alert. He must have something that just keeps pinging, keeps pinging out there. And if it loses like three pings, four pings.
Man, I don't know.
Like,
even if it's
chip in his head flashes.
Even if it's slow, even if it just gets really slow, he knows about it. And I did a blog post last year, basically Scott having a conversation at Mix, a panel discussion at Mix with a couple of other instances of himself.
Yeah, I was about to say, he was cloned. Yeah, yeah. So it must be clone number 72 of Scott.
I don't know, man. I don't know. But if the site's down for, you know, a minute, in the middle of the night, he knows.
So you
asked about horror stories, and I'll give you one to illustrate this idea about how hard it can be to think like a bad guy. I used to work in federal law enforcement technology. And I won't tell you who the agency is, but it's one of those ones with three letters, right? So it's one of the big six.
Oh, gee, thanks. Yeah.
And this was, you know, more than a decade ago. So this agency was, they were starting to network the computers that they use so that their field agents would gather information, and this the information would be, you know, compiled in aggregate, and they would use the information to for investigations that they were working on, right? So they would pull the information and run reports on it, look at the results. And so they were starting to network the computers. And I don't know whether there was a new manager for this particular unit or whatnot, but he implemented a password policy to make sure that, because, you know, this at the federal level, there's a lot of paranoia. Nobody trusts anybody, you know. So they this guy was telling me about how they're, you know, how he'd implemented this password policy so that all the data would be protected. And he told me the rules, and the rules were like, it had to be 15, the password had to be like 15 characters long, and it had to have capitals and lowercase and numbers and non-alpha characters. And so
let me guess, everybody was writing it down and keeping that those passwords in their wallets.
No, so worse than that. So he asked me why I was smiling as he was telling me this, and so I said, well, let's test the hypothesis. And we walked through his unit, and I started, you know, lifting up keyboards or pulling out desk drawers, and, you know, for about a third of them, we could actually find the password with just a few seconds of searching, because he created a password policy that was so difficult people wouldn't remember. But yeah. Here, these guys, their job is to think like, you know, organized criminals or, you know, or drug dealers or gang members, you know, from a criminal perspective. That's what they do. But thinking about a bad guy in that perspective still escaped them.
Yeah. What's the old thing of, I heard some organized crime scheme. They got those thumb-based memory, the USB thumb drives, and just dropped a bunch around the bank. Just mm-hmm. dropped them on the floor, threw them, kind of sent them behind the tellers and stuff. And over half of them were put into USB ports on bank computers.
Right, with auto runs that installed malware.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
so some of the hacking is social. I mean, we can talk about technology hacks and but a lot of it is social engineering.
So the really scary stuff is when you combine technology with social engineering. I gave a talk for the semiconductor industry a few years ago at their symposium on security, and they were interested in the security aspect, but they were having trouble sort of mapping the kinds of things that bad guys could do to the usage scenarios where they use technology. So the guy, he said, I want to paint a picture for you, and I want you to tell me what could go wrong from a security perspective. So the picture the guy painted for me was that he had PC applications that were connected to manufacturing machines, like, you know, mills and lathes and such, and those PCs were networked, and they gathered production information from the machines and sent the data back to a central server. And he said, and those machines aren't connected to the internet. There's a connection to the internet in the office where the server lives, but those machines are just connected to that machine, right? I said, okay, on a TCP/IP network? They said, yes. I said, all right. So they said, you can't get in the door if you don't have a security badge. It's all of our, you know, our employees, you know, so there's no security vulnerability because there's only one pipe out to the internet, goes through the office. You can't get in the building to touch the machines. So I thought for a minute, and I said, okay, how about this? So, and think about the social networking aspect, or the social engineering aspect of this. So I asked him a couple of questions about his business. You run three shifts in the manufacturing plant, right? Yep. How many people? Are there about 1,500 guys at work each shift on the floor? Okay. So the scenario I painted for him is, what if I spent a couple of nights driving around the parking lot recording license plate numbers? And there are services now where you can enter a license plate number and get some information about, you know, who the owner of the register of that vehicle is. And let's suppose that I did that, got their names. Just their names. That's the only thing I could get. And then I get their names, and I write a dictionary parser that takes their first name and their last name and creates combinations of likely email addresses, and I append .aol, .hotmail, .gmail, .whatever. And I just blanket mail every single address that I create, understanding that, you know, 80% of them are going to bounce back. And in that email, I add some dialogue. You know, going broke after your divorce, interested in being part of a class action lawsuit against the state, get 50% of your alimony and child support reimbursed, click here for more information. Click here opens up a dialogue that doesn't say click yes to download and install this software. It says click here, says, you know, click yes to, you know, continue on to get more information or whatever. And thing pops up, right? But of the 200 people out of the 1,200 that I actually managed to get an email address to, because this guy admitted that they check their email at night on their workstations, what if I can get 20 of those 200 to actually install some stuff on that machine? All I need is one set of wares to be installed that's connected to a TCP/IP network that I can start talking to. A great scenario that I did with, this is a company that I owned before I came to work at Microsoft. I got hired by a CFO and asked to breach their company's network security. And the deal was nobody else in the company, including the CEO, knew that he had hired me. So it was all, I mean, literally.
Totally
like,
just anonymous.
Yeah, literally like I made him, you know, get me certified documentation that went in, that was held in escrow so that if, you know, when I succeeded and I got, and we, you know, or we got caught, I could prove, because there was only one guy that knew that we had been hired. And so they were a e-commerce company. This was during the dot-com boom, and they were rapidly growing the amount of revenue that they were generating on a day-to-day basis. And so there was some concern, and he hired me because he was sure that they were secure. So they had, you know, physical security. It was like Star Trek. You had to go through this, you know, tube booth with handprint and analyzers and everything just to get into the computer room. So and, you know, I wasn't allowed any special access. I had to hack it as though I was a real hacker. So I searched press releases and found a press release from a company that that provided credit card processing software. And this was back before .NET. So they used Commerce Server as a product, and it was there was a pipeline. You could plug ActiveX components into the pipeline. So I called the company that they had done this press announcement with and said, "Hi, I'm, you know, Tom, and I'm starting this e-commerce company, and I'm evaluating payment components, but I'm concerned about whether or not your components can handle the massive volume, the millions of dollars that we're going to process. So I'm wondering if you have trial version and trial accounts so I can do a proof of concept before I actually commit." They said, "Sure." They sent me a copy of the software, all the documentation, including the programmer's API, and I wrote a version of the control that had a similar API and appeared to do exactly what the real one did, except for did a couple of other things, right? So it like took that credit card information and in addition to passing it through to the real control, right, the one that actually processed the payments, it every once in a while piggybacked on some outbound communication and sent all of that data to a catching point that was on one of my servers. And right, so the real problem, the problem wasn't the technology, that was easy, right? So I just, you know, I changed, you know, you can hack the GUID of the real component, created another one that looked the same, did some extra stuff, and then called the actual component. So to the company, when the software was running, it would look to them like it was doing exactly what it was supposed to do. The technology was the easy part. The hard part was how was I going to get it installed?
Right.
Right. So I sent them a letter on fake letterhead from what looked like the software company that said, in the next 72 hours, you will receive a critical security patch to our e-commerce products. We're letting you know in advance so that you will have 48 hours to install this before we notify the public that this massive security vulnerability has been distributed. Please be certain that you install it so that you don't become a victim of credit card number theft when we advise the public that we found this vulnerability." So I sent that letter, sent it directly to the, you know, the CTO or whoever was the, you know, and then 3 days later, I sent by Federal Express a CD, right, that, you know, I had burned and then, you know, used a CD printer and made it look just like the, you know, the one that I had gotten from the original company.
Yeah, so you had
So I sent it by FedEx, and by that afternoon, I had a flow of data because, you know, the operations guys went, whoa, this is the critical patch we've been waiting for to keep our applications secure.
That's a great story. That's awesome.
And so what did his CEO, what was the look
at? Yeah,
so
give us the backstory on this.
Went back to him and said, here's 2 pages of the reams of paper that I have at home, but here's everything. So you bring a wheelbarrow and a paper and go.
No, so I brought a list of, like, you know, 2 days worth of credit card numbers that had been submitted for him to check against their actual sales, and it was the CFO, the conversation was sort of interesting. He sort of had a pensive look on his face, and then handed me a check for the balance of the services due and yet another copy of the NDA that I'd signed, reminding me that, you know, if I discovered a security vulnerability, it was our secret until death. And I don't know what took place after that, but the data stopped right away, you know, the flow of data. So
Joe, we're getting ready to wrap up here at DevLink. Give us some information about what your team is doing and stuff.
Well, one of the cool parts about my job is that, you know, Scott and Simon will every once in a while say, hey, I want you to focus on, you know, these three things for a while. And so one of the things, I did a lot of security work, you know, earlier in my days at Microsoft, and one of the things that I'm focused back on is to do a ton of security stuff. So I've started a security-specific blog, securedeveloper.com, that I hope folks will check out, but I'm engaging different parts of Microsoft to do a ton of security stuff. So among them are going to be, I've committed to 100 security-related videos, so I've just published the first dozen or so on the ASP.NET authentication mechanism. I'm going to do a collection of podcasts. I'm not exactly sure what the publishing mechanism is going to be, but all the stuff will be found on the ASP.NET site. So if you go to www.asp.net/learn is sort of the launching point for all of this stuff. A lot of the stuff that I'm going to do in the next few months is going to be around the secure development lifecycle. So I'm working with the SDL team to sort of expose that and help folks not only understand, like, how to build security into the whole lifecycle, but not to use ours, but to take the example that we provide that's based on our secure development lifecycle and integrate it into whatever their development lifecycle is. So whether they're, you know, a classical lifecycle or whether they use agile methods or what have you, you know, how to build it into the way that they build software. We're going to do a whole series of webcasts. I did a couple of seasons of a webcast series called the Digital Black Belt Series. At the end of the series, people that came to the whole series actually got a black belt. That's a Microsoft black belt. And it was funny. I was at Tech Ed a few months ago, and some guy walked up to me wearing the black belt that he got during that series.
Oh, that is so awesome.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
So we're working on getting funding to get a bunch more of those black belts made. And the on-demand content is great because it's very fixed, you know, very short length. But the webcast series is great because you can come and bring your questions, and it's sort of more of a dialogue. And I'm certainly, you know, I'd love to hear suggestions that other folks have about, you know, how to be more interactive in terms of specifically helping folks solve their security concerns.
How can people get a hold of you?
So the best way to get a hold of me is to contact me through my blog, www.misfitgeek.com. There's a contact button there. Or just joe.stagner.
Behind the
or just joe.stagner@microsoft.com.
Cool. Well, thanks, Joe. I really appreciate you coming on the show and kind of filling us in on some stuff. And good luck with all the podcasts and the screencasts and everything.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for inviting me down to DevLink. This has been great.
It's awesome to have you here, Joe. It really is.
It's, by
the way, you're doing the closing keynote. So what's the topic for the closing keynote? Because we talked last night and you're like, I'm not sure yet.
Well, so the topic is the new web. Like, what, you know, what's happening? What comes next? Really, that's all I can tell you because I still haven't worked it all out yet.
Well, that's good. Well, we do appreciate you coming on the show for Deep Fried Bites. So I'm sure we'll get you back on. We always run into you here and there. So it's great having you. Tell the goo I said hello.
I will do that.
And hello, everybody.
All 3 or 4.
All right, folks, that's another episode of Deep Fried Bites. We certainly appreciate our special guest, Joe Stagnar, coming all the way out to DevLink. We're going to be doing some more shows later on. So until next time, folks, keep your tea glasses full and your axes sharp. We'll see you.
Yeah.